of our 10th anniversary program of the Blount County Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm Helen Sims, and I am an alcoholic. This seems to be the lady drunk's day. We all seem to be at the head table. We just let him come along. I'd like to ask Merle to read the purpose. I'm Merle Millsaps, and I had no trouble whatever qualifying as an alcoholic. In fact, Fred S. from Sweetwater still calls me Shaky, and that's been almost 4 years ago. This is the purpose of AA. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Thank you, Merle. I'd like to ask Julia M. to read the steps.
I'm Julia Moorhead, a member of this group, and I am an alcoholic. Our first step, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. We, too, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, we were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all the persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry the message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Thank you, Juju. Now, for the moment we've all waited for, I'll ask Doris to introduce our speaker.
Am I the moment that you've all waited for? For the benefit of those who were here last year and the new ones, I'll qualify this. I sound like Minnie Pearl on here, and I know it. They all know it. I said it last year, and I'm here my second year, and I'm just as proud to be here as I can be. If I look slightly haggard and sound shaky and beat up this morning, it's because of the southern charm around this place. Don't laugh, Dottie. A bunch of us went out last evening, and Dottie from Atlanta, and I think most of you know her and can understand this, was the southern belle from Atlanta there. She monopolized the whole evening. All the men sat at the end where she was. I sat there worrying about it, you know. Every once in a while, she'd throw in, "Don't you think so, Doris?" And I thought, "Hell no, but it's I." Speaking of this southern charm, our guest this morning is from New York, and I had had some correspondence, a few conversations concerning her, and I knew that she would leave New York early in June. She was going to Palm Springs and Hawaii, back to Oregon, and then on to Maryville. Now, what do we offer a person that's been there? And I thought, well, you know, our southern hillbilly hospitality and charm, we can do that. And I immediately got off on the wrong foot. We went to the airport to meet her, and I didn't want to make a mistake of not recognizing her. I wouldn't have known Hazel Rice last year. I expected this flugy from New York to come down all dressed, you know, and make us feel like little hick country girls. And I was scared to death, and here came Hazel, just as calm and ladylike, and I felt perfectly at home with her. And so this year I thought, well, I'll be the same kind of woman, you know, but and I won't be able to recognize her. And I'm casting no aspersions on Cora Louise, but really she does look like what I expected last year, except she isn't a fluke. But anyway, had her paged and said Cora Bedford from New York. So the boy paged and waited, nobody came. And finally here came this prissy, cute, well-dressed, vivacious little woman down the by the ticket office. And she said, "I think I was being paged a minute ago." Says, "There must be a mistake." Says, "My name is Cora Louise Bedford." And he said, well, he was paging Cora Bedford. "Well, I'm Cora Louise Bedford." And I thought, well, my problem solved there. This northern southerner, you know, this drippy, honey voice. And I thought, my entertainment's over. She's got it. Anyway, she is a lovely person, and she has been entertaining me ever since she came, what time I've got to spend with her. And rather than my having to go out of my way to do anything, you know, and try to draw her story out, she has been so gracious and let me tell mine. And now I would like to hear her story for a change, and I am very, very happy to have the honor of introducing Cora Louise Bedford from New York City.
What can I say now? I am Cora Louise Bedford. And I'm an alcoholic, and hi, everybody. I'm a very grateful alcoholic. First of all, of course, I'm grateful to be sober today. And next, I can't tell you how grateful I am to be here with all of you and to be on the receiving end of so much southern charm. It does make me feel at home to be back in the South, with so many people who are just like the people that I grew up with. I was born and raised in Greenville, Mississippi, and from the time way before I could remember it, we spent the summers at Sewanee, Tennessee, which is not too far from here. I spent the war years in Sewanee while my husband was overseas. I was married there before that. My husband is from Savannah, Georgia, and we lived in Georgia for the first 5 years that we were married. And we've been living in New York ever since the Second World War. That's being a little over-preserved in alcohol, isn't it, from the First World War. But whereas we live there and we think of New York as home because that's where our children grew up, that's where I found AA, still our roots are deep in the South. And I have a feeling that we have a lot of things that we share, membership in this fellowship, as well as this Southern background, and it's marvelous for me to be here. I'm so grateful for the opportunity. Palm Springs was wonderful. Hawaii was wonderful. Oregon was great. But I really feel that I'm back home now that I'm here with all of you. I'm one of the people who loves AA anniversaries, both individual ones and group ones, because I think they are a testimony to the fact that our program works, that through the 12 steps individually, we're able to maintain our recoveries a day at a time. And through the 12 traditions, we're able to maintain our group unity a day at a time. And I would like to congratulate the Blount County group of AA on their 10th anniversary. And thank you for giving me the opportunity to be here and participate in it. Every day I like to remember the debt of gratitude that I owe, that all of us owe, that through the grace of God, 33 years ago, Bill found Dr. Bob in Akron, Ohio, and began the experience which all of us now participate in, of one drunk talking to another, sharing their experience, strength, and hope together, speaking in the language of the heart. And they began that day in Akron the chain reaction, which is still going on all over the world, and for which none of us can foresee an end. I'm grateful to Bill that, through the grace of God, he had the foresight to insist on the publication of our books, to insist on the necessity for having a general service office in New York, to insist on the fact that we needed a general service conference, and second only to my gratitude for being a member of this fellowship, I'm grateful to be on the staff of our general service office, yours and mine, in New York. This has been one of the great experiences of my life. I wish every one of you would have the opportunity to be a delegate to New York. I know this isn't possible, but I know you know from the people who have been delegates that anyone who really gets involved in AA service and who participates in the conference becomes as enthusiastic and as proud of this as all of us who work in the office. I have always felt that pride was a dirty word in AA, and I suppose many of you might agree with me. But when it comes to our office, I don't really feel that way, because the office represents the accomplishments of the entire fellowship of AA over the past 33 years. The accomplishments of this office are not the accomplishments of the particular staff or general manager who are there now or who have been there at any other time. It doesn't even represent the particular accomplishments of Bill himself, but the accomplishment of AA groups and members all over the world. To many of you, I know box 459 is simply a post office box number, but it really is a place, and it's a place where there are people, some AAs, there are seven AA staff members, an AA general manager, and three AAs who are on the staff of the Grapevine. The other 40 or so people who work there are non-alcoholics. We welcome visitors, and we hope that all of you can take the opportunity sometime to come to New York, and that when you do, you can pay us a visit. I often feel that if the visitors who do come to our office could spare the time to go to the conference room with a week's supply of correspondence folders and read through these, that they would get some general idea of the breadth and scope of the work that our office is trying to perform. We are simply trying to perform the job that AA asks us to do. This is simply the place where it gets done. And we are the people who at the present time are doing the work. But the work that's being done is the work that you tell us you want to have done. You tell us this individually through correspondence or through your service structure, your GSRs, your committee members, and your delegate when he comes to New York. And this is the two-way sharing that goes on. Before I went to work in the office, I was a little uneasy about sitting behind a desk on the 18th floor of a New York office building and reading and answering letters and working on committees and doing all that kind of thing. I had the feeling that it might be a little remote from the fellowship itself. Along with a lot of other things, I turned out to be wrong on that, and how glad I am to promptly admit that I was wrong about that, because never have I felt so completely involved and immersed in AA as I do now. The names on a letter soon become not just names, but real people. And the great thing is that we often have the opportunity to go out to meetings like this and see the people whose names have been assigned to those letters. I also wondered what it was going to be like to work in an office with 7 women. I thought, my goodness, you know how competitive women are with each other and that kind of thing, and, you know, is this going to shake me up as a member of AA? There couldn't be 7 more different types than the 7 of us are. But the wonderful thing in AA is that none of us has to be competitive. We don't have prestige jobs in our office. We don't have important and unimportant assignments. The most important assignment and the one you love the best always seems to be the one that you're doing at the minute, that year. Each one of us rotates every 2 years so that eventually what's somebody else's job this year will be your job. All of us are there for the same reason, in spite of the fact that we are so different in temperament, in personality, in appearance, and in particular abilities and so on. We're all there with a common purpose, which is to serve as best we can the common welfare of our beloved fellowship. I wish I had time in this morning to take you on a tour of the office, to describe the job of the conference secretary, the job of the staff coordinator, the job of the institution secretary, the job of the public information secretary, the overseas service, what we do in the various committees. And there's not time for that, but someday perhaps you'll have the opportunity to read all about these things in the various reports that come out. The conference report will be available soon, and it will tell you a little bit at least about all of these things. I can't tell you what a matter of great awe and wonder it is to me that I can be there and participate in the AA experience in this way of trying to extend the hand of AA, your hand and my hand, to anyone, anywhere, who asks for help. As you can see, I could talk a great deal longer about the office, but I realize that's not the reason that I was invited here. I was invited here to tell you my story, and I am always grateful to have the opportunity to do this, because this is the story of the transforming experience of my life, and I love to share it with AA members who gave me this transforming experience. I hope that in the process of telling this story, I'll be able to express to you in any way at all the real depth of my gratitude to AA for making it possible for me even to begin the process of becoming what I hope is a new and different kind of person, because during the years that I drank, I became the kind of person that I never wanted to be, destructive, irrational, unpredictable. When I came to my first AA meeting, I had really come to the end of my own resources. These had been considerable. The 8 or 9 years that preceded my arrival into AA were years during which I stretched and extended myself in every imaginable way, looking for answers to the problems and confusions and complexities of living that seemed to be pressing in so heavily on me that I almost sank from the weight of them. At that time, I would not have believed it possible that the day would ever come when I would be able to look back on those terrible years and accept the fact that in my case, they were probably the necessary preparation for the kind of thing that began happening when I came into AA. I apparently was one of the people who simply had to go through the painful and often humiliating experiences of those years in order to be able to engage in any kind of a self-confrontation. And partial, though this confrontation still is and probably will remain, I have learned some things from it that I didn't learn through any other means. I learned, I am learning, and I will have to continue to learn that I not only do not, but that I cannot control anything or anyone by my efforts alone, not even myself. I need help in this, the kind of help that comes from the grace of God and from the love and support of friends both inside and outside the fellowship of AA. I had to learn that all these complexities and ambiguities of living that I had thought were unique with me are simply part of the human condition, and that they are the common experience of all people who haven't got it made yet, but who are simply on the way, making the journey, as Tom said last night. I've had to learn to accept with gratitude the fact that as of today, I am at least on the way, and that I will be extremely lucky if I can stay there, because I will never arrive, I will never get there, and it would be very dangerous, maybe fatal, if I should ever think I had arrived. I had to learn that I don't have to be a hero. I don't have to be a winner. That the times in my life that I've ever really won have often been the times when I seem to be losing. For instance, when I lost the battle with booze. I am coming to learn, I am trying to learn, that I have the right to be wrong, that I have the right to make errors in judgment and poor choices, that I even have the right to fail seriously in the things that matter most to me, and that the only thing that would be really fatal, I think, would be if I should cease to care, if I should cease to be really concerned and truly committed to the principles of our program and to the power greater than myself that I call God. I never have been a person who liked himself very much. I think I like myself better than I used to, but not as well as I hope I'm going to. I've never been a person who had any real confidence in my ability to accomplish anything worthwhile. But as time has gone on, this doesn't seem to matter so much anymore, because as long as I have faith in God, it really doesn't matter whether I have faith in myself or not, because I can place my hands, myself, in the hands of the power greater than myself, where I always should have placed my reliance. When all of this began for me, I didn't knowingly reach out and seek this act of grace, which ultimately saved me. I was much too sunk in my own self-hatred and despair to be able to reach out and ask for help for myself. And so I can only believe that God in his loving mercy reached down and found me. I'm not able to explain this, of course. I can't give a logical reason for it. I certainly know that I was no more deserving of this wonderful gift than any of those people who may still be lost as I was. I certainly don't pretend to understand the mysteries of divine providence. I only know that this great thing happened to me and that I'm grateful for it beyond anything in my life. For an alcoholic, I think that I probably began to drink with regularity sort of late in life. I was 26 years old, married, and the mother of two little girls before drinking was anything but a very occasional thing. And it was during the war, while my husband was overseas, that I began to drink daily with other war widows like myself. We used to get together in the afternoons and share our experience, strength, and hope over a couple of drinks. And they were all good drinkers, and so was I thought. Actually, I did have two or three good years before the axe finally fell. I think now that probably from the start I somehow knew that my drinking was different from that of my friends. I was fully accustomed to thinking of myself as being different, so this didn't seem so unusual to me. The difference lay not so much in my performance while I was drinking, in my ability to handle it, as it did in my attitude toward it. Because from the very beginning, I started associating all experiences of fun and relaxation and release from anxiety and tension with those times that I drank. This wasn't a matter of great concern to me as long as I was able to handle it well in fairly large amounts. And then one night, without any forewarning or any gradual build-up at all, and I still think this is true today, I was at a party, drinking in the usual manner and in the usual amounts, but a very strange thing happened. I got terribly drunk, and I had a blackout, and I was completely unprepared for both of these things. I had always taken the attitude that if a person couldn't drink well, he simply shouldn't drink at all. You can see I had a little way to fall from this arch position that I was maintaining. I had never even heard of a blackout at this time. I didn't know what it was. It happens that in my drunken stupor the night before, I had fallen down a flight of steps and landed on my head on a stone terrace, and I really thought I must be suffering from a concussion, and that's why I didn't remember anything. And this should have been the giveaway. I was much too ashamed of the cause of this fall to go to a doctor and have an examination. By this time, I was living in New York, and I was already under the care of a psychotherapist for reasons that clearly were not connected with drinking, because drinking had never been a problem to me until this time. And so the next time I saw the therapist, I described this strange phenomenon which had occurred in my life. And in innocence and good faith, he said to me all the things that I really wanted to hear. He told me that this was the kind of thing that could happen to anyone occasionally, that fundamentally he thought it represented a sort of, it was indicative at least, of a very difficult period that we were going through in the treatment, but that he was sort of cheered up by this fact because it indicated to him that perhaps there had been a breakthrough in my armor and at least liquor could get to me now. He did suggest, however, that this could be pretty troublesome business if it occurred too often. And so he suggested that at least until such time as we could resolve these difficulties and conflicts, that perhaps I should be extra careful about any drinking that I did. And how that word careful came back to haunt me. I tried so hard to be careful. I tried every way I could think of and every way that anyone could suggest to me to be careful. The trouble was, of course, that I had already lost the ability to be careful, though neither the therapist nor I were aware of this. Neither one of us were aware that I had crossed whatever that invisible line is that separates those people who can drink successfully from those who can't, that I had a broken strainer, as Julian said the other night. We didn't know that. Neither one of us were aware at this time that drinking had already become the imperative factor in my life. By that, I don't mean to say that I ever was drunk every day or even that I got drunk every single time that I drank. But from then on, I lost the ability to call the shots, to be able to guarantee that I would be sober at a given time and place, no matter how important that might be. And the question of to drink or not to drink really motivated practically everything that I did. Before long, my life became something straight out of Alice in Wonderland, and that's the only way that I know how to describe it. I had to come to be able to believe 7 impossible things every morning. I reminded myself of the Red Queen when she was talking to Alice in Wonderland, and she said, down here, we have to run as fast as we can to stay where we are. I was running faster and faster all the time. Ostensibly, I think I seemed to be staying where I was. People who knew me well knew better. I knew better. I was terrified. I could feel myself slipping. I was terrified by this growing emptiness, by this despair which was growing inside of me. I knew that I was dying inside, that I was shriveling up like a leaf on a tree, but I didn't know what to do about it. Knowing all of these things, I kept trying to fill this emptiness and quiet these fears with the contents of a bottle. And so I plunged in time after time, always thinking that one day things would be better. One day I would be able to drink as I had drunk before and get that sort of dead center equilibrium which I had thought liquor gave me. I simply was unable to believe that I had been licked by a thing like booze. I most heartily did believe that if I could only find the key that would unlock the door and emancipate what everyone referred to as the real me, I would be able to put some order in my life, and that in that order, drinking would fall into its proper place. And I was supported in this view by my family, my therapist, and a great many people who knew me well. And it really wasn't too unusual in the circumstances, if you'll consider the fact that I had already been sufficiently disturbed by life problems to seek professional help almost 2 years before drinking became any kind of a problem to me. The fact that during this period I was the most advised and counseled person in the world, that if you were in what people call the helping professions, you had my trade, I came to see you. The fact that none of these people who tried so hard, family, friends, professional people, the fact that they couldn't help me with my drinking was not because they didn't try. They surely did. No one could have helped me with my drinking at this time because I didn't want the only kind of help which means anything. I didn't want anybody to tell me that I had to stop drinking. I wanted them to tell me how I could learn to drink successfully. As a matter of fact, when I went to all these people for help, I rarely talked to them about drinking at all. I talked to them about my other problems, and I thought they were smart enough to know that if I occasionally drank too much, it was because of all these other problems that I had. And so I put myself on a treadmill of activity. I began this search for this real me. And I endowed this search with every ounce of energy and imagination and resourcefulness that I had for 8 or 9 years. And these attributes were considerable. I continued to search in psychotherapy. But by now I was living everything out. There was no possibility for anything constructive to happen in the therapy as long as I was drinking the way that I was. I searched for it in an attempted but abortive career. I was incapable of sustained activity of any kind, and so naturally I couldn't pursue even a simple career, let alone a complicated and difficult one such as I had in mind for myself. I searched for it in books and in study. I was always running off to Columbia University or to the New School or to NYU taking a course, thinking that if I could only learn how people had lived successfully, that I would be able to apply their techniques to my life and that I, too, would learn to live successfully. But somehow I never was able to, you know, find the points that all of these things made because this was too tough. I searched for this elusive creature in worthy causes. thinking that if I could find something larger than myself, which I could give myself to, that I would find my way, and that once again, drinking would fall into its proper place and would not have this undue importance for me. I searched for it in domesticity and home life. I couldn't clean up my own life. I couldn't clean up the mess that was inside of me. And so consequently, I became a compulsive sort of housekeeper. My house has never been so clean. I never did so much fancy cooking. And I never entertained so much as I did during those years. I searched for my answers in my religion. But I was very busy at that time, making sure that God knew what my will for me was. It never occurred to me to seek His will for me and the power to carry that out. And I even used to search for this real me out at Ebbets Field in the days when the Dodgers were still in Brooklyn. I knew that if I had a season ticket and that I had to show up out there every day, or at least 77 days a year, that this might exercise some control. I would want to be sober so that I could get there and so that I could get home. Also, it was healthy. It was outside and it was in the sunshine. And I became deeply involved in baseball and loved it and felt like all the players were my children. And this was something larger than I was, but I kept right on drinking. One of the telltale signs with me, I remember, the last summer before I came into AA in the fall, was that I watched the telecast of a game that was being played in Milwaukee, which was 3 hours different from our time, so it was late when the game was over. And the next morning, I couldn't remember what the score was, and I had to sneak out and buy a newspaper to find out who won the game, which I had sat up to watch on television the night before. Simultaneously, inevitably, and always, I continued to search for this creature in a bottle. And here in the bottle, I always did find a key. But the door that this key unlocked was the door to a Pandora's box of destructive, irrational, unpredictable behavior. The chaos and confusion that were created in my life and in the lives of all those people who were close to me by this attempt of mine to live two lives at the same time, one on a rational, constructive plane, and the other on the dark side of reality, the irrational, destructive plane. This chaos finally brought me to the point of despair where nothing seemed worth the candle anymore. The gap was too wide. The gap between the person who made attempts at worthwhile living and this creature who was so beset by obsessive and compulsive drinking that she poisoned and kicked over every good thing that she did. This gap seemed to me too wide to breach, and I could not imagine that there would ever be a bridge that could span it. So I decided that I was just some sort of no-good freak who had had every opportunity that a person could be given in life and still couldn't make the scene, as the kids say. It was in this bleak and black frame of mind that I showed up at my first AA meeting, because even in my what I thought was utter despair, I did somehow know that I had to do something about the drinking. When I decided that the thing that I had to try was AA, I felt like my life was over. Any meaningful part of it, at least, was over. I thought that I had used up my chances and run out of time, and that all the rest was ashes. And imagine my surprise when, after I had been going to AA meetings for just a little while, I really did find that key that I had been looking for such a long time in so many places. It didn't unlock all the doors. It still hasn't. I know it never will. But it began what I hope will be a continuing process of opening one door at a time as I can grow up enough to walk inside. But I found the key that opened the first door when I was able to accept the fact that I was an alcoholic, when I was able to accept the fact that there was nothing in the world that I could do to change that, and nothing anyone else could do to change that, but that I could change the meaning of it and take the destruction out of it by becoming a sober alcoholic one day at a time. I consider it something of a miracle that AA ever occurred to me as a possibility in the first place, because I was one of the people who was guilty of contempt prior to investigation. I thought I was much too smart, much too sophisticated, much too hip for the kind of organization that I thought AA was. You know, thinking back on those last days and weeks before I came into AA, I was recently struck by what some people might consider to be the long arm of coincidence. But I don't think that it was the long arm of coincidence, and I don't think that many of you will either. About a week before I had my moment of truth and made my move, about a week before that, I had called the children's pediatrician, who was also a close personal friend and a neighbor, and asked him if he and his wife could come over one evening, and that evening, immediately, of course, if they could come over and we could have some discussion about a problem that I was having with one of the children, and they consented to do this. And by the time they came, I was already tight. I was certainly not drunk at all, but I was tight. And I sat down with the doctor, and I told him my troubles and my problem and asked for his advice. And he said to me, "I have to say something that's going to make you very mad, but I can't hesitate any longer." He had been at my house many times before. He said, "I don't think what I'm going to say is the cause of these problems that you're now having necessarily. But I think, unless you do something about your drinking, you're not going to be able to solve these problems or any other problems. I think you've lost control of your drinking." And he was right. He sure did make me mad. I wasn't mad with the doctor, but I was furious with my husband because I was pretty sure he must have been talking to the doctor. The doctor, of course, had had many opportunities to observe me in this condition many other times. He said to me, "Ruth Fox," and she's a psychiatrist in New York who is well known as someone who understands alcoholism and treats alcoholics. As a matter of fact, she'd been on the television the week before, and I had seen her, but the minute she began to talk about alcoholism, I switched to another channel. If I saw the word alcoholism on a page in the newspaper or a book or a magazine, I turned the page quickly. I didn't want to see anything about this. I didn't want to have to think about this subject. And the doctor said to me, "I want you to let me call Ruth Fox. She's a friend of mine, and I want to make an appointment for you, and I want you to go to see her. She treats lots of alcoholics, and she might be able to help you." And I said, "No, I don't want you to make the appointment. No more money is going to be spent on me in psychiatry. We'll just have to find another way." And so for the next few days, I drank more than I had ever drunk in my life. We got into more trouble at home than I can ever remember our getting into. And I remember my husband saying to me one morning, "If we have one more night like the one we had last night, I'm going to call Milton and ask him to put you in the hospital." He said, "I can't go through with this. You're dangerous to yourself and you're dangerous to the rest of us." As far as I know, I didn't continue to think about the conversation that the doctor and I had had, but of course it must have been working away at me. And exactly a week after that, when I was sitting in the kitchen, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, having postponed taking the first drink as long as I possibly could, and I had started to drink. Only this day there was a difference, because with the very first drink, I had known, as I had known countless other times before, that this was going to be one of those days when there just was not enough liquor in the world to do for me whatever it was that I seemed to need so desperately to have done. And suddenly I was struck by a sickening shock of recognition. Recognition of the helplessness, the hopelessness, the near despair of my situation. And then without a conscious thought or a plan in my head, I got up and I went to the telephone And I called my husband, and for the first time in my life, I said something to him that was appropriate about my drinking. I said, please try not to be angry with me. I know I'll be drunk by the time you get home tonight. But try to bear with me this one more time, because I hope it may be the last. And then from out of nowhere, somehow, I found the words that subsequently saved my life. I said, if you'll call AA and find out where their meetings are, I'm willing to give it a try. I'm not sure that I'm an alcoholic, I said. I know if I am, it isn't my fault, but it will be my fault if I don't try to find out and do something about it. Besides, I said, we know that AA has helped lots of people with drinking problems, and it doesn't cost a thing. So what do I have to lose? What did I have to lose? What an irony that turned out to be. All I had to lose was all those things that had weighed so heavily on me all these years that I had almost sunk from the weight of them. Things like guilt and shame and anxiety and alienation. And instead to begin to find some of those things that I had been looking for so frantically and in so many places all those years. Things like faith and friendship and meaning and purpose in my life. But, of course, I didn't know then that any of this was going to happen. I hung up the phone with my husband, and I no sooner put it on the hook than it rang. And I picked it up, and it was this doctor who had been with us the week before. He said, I want to know whether you've been thinking about our conversation that we had last week. And I said, it's uncanny that you should call at this minute. I have just hung up the telephone. And somehow, I said, I don't know how, but I said to Lee if he would find out about AA, that I'd be willing to go to a meeting. And the doctor said, my God, I wouldn't have dared suggest it. He said, if you'll do this, this is the very best possible thing that you can do. He said, the mother of one of my patients is an AA member. As a matter of fact, she works in their office. He was talking about Lib, whom many of you know. And he said, I think it's the most remarkable organization I know about and certainly the very best thing for an alcoholic. And I said, but Milton, I'm scared to death. I don't know how I happened to make this suggestion to Lee. I said, I'm absolutely terrified. And do you think it would be too infantile if I asked Lee to go to the meeting with me? He said, heavens no, be sure to ask him to go. And if he won't go, let me know and I'll take you. Nobody said to me, I don't really think you need that organization. Going to that AA meeting to this day remains the most difficult single step that I have ever had to take in my life. I told you that I was guilty of contempt prior to investigation. I told you that I wasn't really convinced that I was an alcoholic because none of the terrible things had happened to me that I thought had to happen in order to qualify one as an alcoholic. I had never been unable to get sober on my own. I couldn't stay sober, it's true, but I could always get sober. I had not only never been hospitalized for alcoholism, I'd never had a doctor to take care of me up to that point as a result of alcoholism. I had never been a morning drinker or a binge drinker or an around-the-clock drinker. I had even ceased to be a daily drinker some time before coming into AA and my efforts at control, and I certainly had never been in any trouble with the law. I had lost very little in tangible ways. I still had my health, my home, my family, most of the friends that I really cared about, and I still had the price of the next bottle. Besides that, I was terrified. I was scared literally to death. And I think now that the reason that I was so frightened and one reason it took me such a long time to admit that I was an alcoholic was that I was not in the least sure that I could stop drinking. And so therefore I was extremely reluctant to admit that there was any necessity to and then fail in the attempt. I was sick with shame and humiliation, guilt. I felt as though I had been permanently broken in spirit. I learned later that what was broken was my pride and my will. These are the things that had suffered a mortal blow, and I hope they never fully recover, but at that time I was still bleeding and it hurt. And I can remember walking out of the house that September night, standing on the front porch, and thinking, boy, you've really lost now. You may have thought you were lost before, but this is it. Now you're really being plunged into the darkness. And little did I know that that darkness would turn out to be better than light and better than any way that I had ever known. And so, defeated, empty, helpless, I went to that first AA meeting. And it is my opinion that this was my very first step in the direction of choosing God's will for me instead of my own. And this is all I claim now for my whole life, is just a change in direction. Because of this experience, which turned out to be a transforming one for me, I began to be able to say yes to what has often seemed to me to be a very hard way, and that can be any way that doesn't happen to be my own way. And also because of this experience, I learned not to be terrified and scared to the point of paralysis of defeat and emptiness and helplessness. After all, once I was defeated by booze, and it worked out for the very best possible good, and this could happen again. We know that nature abhors a vacuum, so emptiness is going to be filled. The choice is what we're going to fill it with. And helplessness of the kind that I am talking about, the kind that makes me throw myself on the mercy of God, knowing that of myself I have no power to help myself, this kind of helplessness, I think, is to be cherished, or at least it is for me. Because once my helplessness made of me an open channel so that I could receive the grace of God, not because I was good or obedient or deserving or righteous, but simply because I was helpless, this wonderful thing happened to me. It was through this experience that I began to feel the power of God's forgiveness in my own life. It was through this experience that I began to be aware that the power of God's love could overcome this death that had been within me. It was through this experience that I began to be able to open my eyes and observe the awesome and wonderful mystery of God at work in people and through people, even me. And so what I had thought of as a plunge into the darkness turned out instead to be a leap of faith, a faith that was born initially of fear, frustration, despair, defeat, and failure. And I wonder now how I can ever really be afraid again. I wonder how frustration and disappointment and heavy blows and failure could ever bring me to that ragged edge of despair again. After all, I've been there. And it was at a time like that that I took the first steps in the life of faith. I went to the AA meeting and began to walk with all of you. I remember the things that happened at that first AA meeting better than I remember the things that happened yesterday. And I think one reason I remember it all so vividly is that I had somehow been opened up. I remember it so vividly because, as far as I know, it was the very first time in my life that I ever had an experience like this. I went to that meeting, and somehow, certainly not through any doing of my own, I was able to suspend opinion and criticism and analysis and judgment, and instead to listen and consequently to learn a little bit. And I heard things that I'm pretty sure were not deeply profound, but somehow they hit with me. I heard them and it meant something to me. The man who was leading the beginners meeting this night said that one couldn't be a little bit alcoholic any more than one could be a little bit pregnant. It was just a question of how far along the condition had progressed. And all of a sudden, I knew what he meant. I had a brother who was an alcoholic and a very different kind from me. And I thought I was a little bit alcoholic, and he was a real alcoholic. And so here was the answer, that once the process has begun, there's no stopping it, because as I heard a doctor say later, the only difference between alcoholism and pregnancy is that alcoholics never miscarry. They told me that night at that meeting that even though I always had been able to get sober on my own, I apparently was not able to stay sober on my own for any length of time. And they suggested to me that perhaps I might forget about time in the sense of weeks and months and years, and instead to try the AA way and concentrate on one day and on staying away from one drink for one day. Because they told me this is how we stay stopped. Said almost everybody stops drinking and has periods of more or less sobriety. The problem is how you stay stopped. And he said, we practice here what we call the 24-hour program of living. And most of us begin each day by asking the God of our understanding to give us grace to stay away from one drink for one day. And then we go to as many meetings as we possibly can to support us in this effort. Now, I really didn't see what a meeting was going to do for me. After all, I had had an awful lot of advice and counsel and spent an awful lot of money meeting with professional people. And I didn't know what these people could tell me at a meeting that they couldn't tell me right then and there and let me do it and forget all about it. But he told me that's not exactly how it works. He said it's at these meetings where we begin to learn to share our experience, strength, and hope with one another. It's at these meetings where we learn how to use what I secretly thought of as the very corny little slogans. Within a couple of weeks, I couldn't get through 15 minutes of the day without using all five of them, but I had thought they were corny. He said it's at these meetings where we learn to use the serenity prayer, where we learn to use what we used to call nickel therapy. It's now dime therapy. I mean the telephone call, the cup of coffee, the candy bar. All of this sounded ridiculous to me in a way, but I never stopped to think that it sounded ridiculous. I just listened. Thinking back on it, I know it must have sounded ridiculous to me. He said it's at these meetings where we learn how to begin to practice the 12 suggested steps of recovery. Now, this is simple, uncomplicated action. And I was accustomed to complicated action. I didn't think it meant anything unless it was complicated. I know that I would not have believed any of this if I'd read it in a book. I would have thought it was an oversimplification of a very complicated problem. I'm willing to admit that this may be true, while at the same time defending to the death that it is this simple a program which works better than any other that anybody has found so far in helping alcoholics gain and maintain sobriety. But I did believe what I saw at those meetings that I went to, and I went every night for weeks and months, because I believed that you knew what you were talking about. I believed you had suffered what I was suffering, that you had been where I was, and if this could work for you, perhaps it could even work for me. And before long, AA became for me a kind of school. Ironically, after a lifetime of exposure in the academic community, it was in AA, amongst my own kind, ex-drunks, that I began the process of learning the things that I had really always wanted to know, which were how to live a life that had meaning and purpose. And in all of this, I found the tools, the incentive, from the example of people like you. I found the tools from your experience. And I found the courage from your unfailing strength and support to begin to be able to face the realities of my own life on a daily basis. And a whole world of new possibilities became available to me. I wish that I knew how to give thanks for gifts like these, but how can one give thanks for such gifts? I know that I can't, that I don't have the words, and that I never will. And so I have to try to the best of my ability to give at least partial evidence of my gratitude by love and service to this fellowship and to the people in it, who were the ones who first showed me the difference between despair and hope, between futility and a kind of fulfillment, between slavery and freedom, really. In the early weeks that I was going to AA, I heard a woman say that there were two big words in the successful practice of this program, and these words were action and patience. Well, action was something that I understood, because I am by nature a doer, and so here was something that I could use. And almost at once I got on my horse and I was off, very busily involved in all the wonderful activities that AA makes possible for all of us. I learned to be an active and participating member of my own group and throughout the metropolitan area. I had one day a week that I volunteered at the intergroup office and answered the telephones and saw newcomers. I went to visit the AA floor at Towns Hospital at least once a week. I never said no to a 12-step call. My calendar was full of speaking dates. As a matter of fact, AA became almost my entire life, and I had really never been so happy in my life. I was released in a measure that was absolutely new in my experience from the stultifying and paralyzing anxiety and feeling of emptiness and meaninglessness which had characterized my drinking years. Now, all of this that I was doing was hard work, but it was also pretty exciting and rewarding work. And the whole experience of being sober day after day, of being born again, was still so new and so exciting to me. And then after I had been in AA for a few years and I was in the process of taking an inventory, which I regularly have done before my anniversary every year, and I forced myself to recall that I was not just a member of AA. I was a member of a family. I was a member of the church. I was a member of the community. And that sobriety was supposed to help me to become a functioning and participating member in these areas as well. Up until this time, I really don't think I had given a passing thought to anyone who didn't have an alcoholic problem. I didn't think that anyone else had problems. At any rate, not any that I could understand and talk about. Well, after this inventory, this brought me to the very nitty-gritty of some of my problems, and I began to have to deal with the bedrock, because now it became incumbent on me not merely to be sober day after day, but to learn to live a sober life and to practice the principles of this program in all my affairs. Now, this was, and it still is sometimes, a real tough, and it requires patience. That other big word that I'd heard when I first came in, that I had tried to bypass with action, not because I thought it was unimportant, but because it simply didn't mean anything to me. Patience was not even a part of my emotional vocabulary. And I make no claims for having learned the virtue of patience yet. But I think I may have learned some things that are related to it. And it's been during periods of discouragement, when my very best efforts seem to produce so little in the way of any kind of results, that I learned of what little I know about patience. I learned that if I keep on keeping on practicing the principles of this program day after day, that finally I'll come out of this bad period and things will begin to fall into place again. In other words, I couldn't learn patience by simply holding my breath and trying to practice patience, any more than I could learn to be sober by simply holding my breath and not taking another drink. I had to learn to put something else in the place of the negative thing. I put AA in the place of drinking, and in the place of patience, I put the daily practice to the best of my ability of the principles of this program. And I remind myself at these times that the word that's used in the 12th step is practice. We practice these principles. It doesn't say we achieve them. It doesn't say we perfect these principles. It says that we simply are willing to grow along spiritual lines, not that any of us can maintain perfect adherence to these principles. As I told you before, I used to be a great baseball fan, and I used to go early to the games because I liked to watch the fellas have batting practice. It always interested me that the ones who spent the most time in the batting cage practicing were not the Humpty Dumpties who couldn't hit their weight yet. It was the big hitters. It was the fellows who hit over 300. These were the ones that spent a long time in the batting cage practicing. And I remember reading once that the great pianist Paderewski had said that if he failed to practice one day, he knew it. That if he failed to practice for 2 days, the critics knew it. And that if he should fail to practice for 3 days, the whole world would know it. If I should fail to practice these principles, the world would little note. But if I should fail to practice them for any length of time, my world, those people who are close to me and who care about me would know it. Because I've learned from the experience of the people who have gone before me in this fellowship what it is that I must do if I want to avoid a catastrophe of what I think would be major proportions to me and to the people who are close to me. I've talked a little while already, and I could have qualified myself very briefly, and you might have known almost as much about me as I've told you if I had simply told you one story, which I always tell whenever I speak at an open meeting. Not because it's the worst thing I ever did when I was drinking, the most dramatic thing, or the thing with the most far-reaching consequences. I've got bags full of those. I tell this story because it seems to capsule better than any other what my life was like, what might have been expected of me in that life, and what I did with it as a result of alcoholic drinking. My husband is an Episcopal clergyman. He is also the chairman of the Department of Religion at New York University. And a couple of years before I came into AA, he asked me if we could have a dinner party for the faculty and the staff from his department at NYU, and of course I consented to do this, and I worked very hard, really, to make this party a success. Now, on the day of the party, at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I wasn't expecting the company until 7. I was all through my chores, and I was tired, and I thought it would be a good idea if I took a little nap before the company came at 7. And then I had one of those brilliant inspirations that occur with such depressing frequency to alcoholics. I thought it would be a good idea if I had a little glass of sherry to help me become drowsy. Now, sherry wasn't my drink, but at times like this, it always seemed ladylike and safe. However, I had every reason to know better than this, and I knew that a little glass of sherry didn't make me drowsy, that it took a little bottle or two little bottles or a little half gallon of sherry to make me drowsy. Now, I also was one of the alcoholics who knew long before AA that the drink that got me into trouble was not the tenth but the first. I still had no idea of how one stays away from the first drink. I still thought that I could apply reason to this. I still thought that I could say to myself, well, any fool would know enough to be discreet at a time like this and mean it. I wonder how many thousand times before I had said those famous last words to myself with the same dismal results. It was no trouble for me to accept the second step when I showed up. No trouble. Well, I took the first drink, and you can imagine the rest. I didn't have the luck to pass out. I never did. I didn't have sense enough to leave home. I never did that either. I showed up at this party, and I showed up almost falling down drunk, near hysterics as I always was when I drank, muttering a stream of what I hope was incomprehensible gibberish. I say this with some fervor because what I had to say was highly uncomplimentary to my husband, and it was not expressed in the language that people normally associate with a clergyman's wife. Now, the people at this party were almost all total strangers to me. We were Episcopalians, and Episcopalians are fairly tolerant about drinking. But these people at this party came from what I guess you would call a temperance background. They were certainly not what you would call drinkers. Most of them didn't even smoke. As a matter of fact, these were the people that I call squares. You talk about arrogance. Here I was, the boss's wife, clergyman's wife, the hostess, drunk and disorderly, And I had the nerve to refer to these people who were behaving extremely well in what you will admit were very difficult circumstances. I had the nerve to refer to them in what I intended to be insulting terms. We had friends who drank, with whom I frequently pulled off stunts like this. I don't excuse the behavior in any circumstances. What can I say? It was inexcusable, bad-mannered, thoughtless. I don't know. You know. I don't excuse it in any circumstances. But in these particular circumstances, it really was unspeakable. The day after this party, my remorse was something spectacular. I really felt that this had done it, that I never wanted to see the light of day again. I simply wanted to find a hole and crawl into it with the rest of the rats. But I was so involved with my own agony. I was so locked up in my own little private alcoholic trap that I wasn't even able to tell my husband, this poor man that I had disgraced and humiliated. I couldn't even tell him I was sorry. I thought he ought to know that I was sorry. I thought he ought to know that no one would behave this way if she could help herself. I don't know whether he knew that or not. After that party, he did know that I didn't drink any longer because I had unresolved personality problems. I drank now because drinking had become my number one problem. You might imagine that a performance like this would constitute what we call a bottom for somebody in my circumstances. But I didn't draw any such conclusion. I wasn't ready to stop drinking. I didn't think I could stop drinking. In spite of the way it was tearing my life apart, I didn't know how I could live without it. I did decide that something had to be done about the drinking, and I set about to do it with indifferent results, but better than I probably had any right to expect. Only I don't recommend my system to anyone who hasn't tried it. Because I learned some new things about loneliness. I had thought I knew what it was to be lonely. And the fact that I didn't have a good reason to be lonely, with a fine husband and two wonderful children and what should have been an interesting life, the fact that I had these things and still felt as though I would die of loneliness, only convinced me that I was a freak and reinforced all my feelings of failure and inadequacy. But after this party, the loneliness became a really morbid thing because I decided that I wouldn't do any drinking at all when other people were around. And before long, I, who had been and am now a gregarious kind of person, didn't care very much about being with people. I didn't want to make plans to do things with the children in the evenings or during the weekends. I no longer even cared whether my husband sat and talked with me at night after the children had gone to bed. I just wanted them all to get the hell out and leave me alone to drink in peace. Of course, there wasn't any peace. Because there isn't any peace in solitary confinement. And that's what alcohol had made of me. A prisoner. A lost soul in chains. And even though my chains may have been of the crepe paper variety, it's my opinion that these are the very most difficult ones to break. And now, thanks to AA and all of you, I'm no longer a prisoner. I have a choice. I can take one drink with all its consequences, or I can do it the AA way and stay away from one drink for one day. I no longer feel like a lost soul, because even though I may often fail in the performance of my various duties and responsibilities, I have found a way of life here. I have found some shape, some form for my life. I have found some not too clearly defined goals, but I have found 12 steps, which I believe are the way toward any goal that I might rightly pursue. And I told you that it was often during periods of discouragement that I have learned the most. And this has been true in so many ways. When I have these low spells, I very quickly revert to the old ways. I begin to slam the doors and kick the furniture and mutter under my breath and curse a little bit and think, oh, gosh, Have I sold myself a bill of goods? You know, my very best efforts seem to produce so little in the way of any kind of tangible results, and I really wonder if there's anything different in my life except that I'm sober. And this stops me. This stops me. When I first came to AA, the only thing in the world that I was looking for or even hoped to find here was sobriety. Everything else. And there has been so much that my cup runs over. I found new happiness in family life and in the well-being of my husband and children. I found that I can hold a responsible job, and at long last I have one that I really love. I've learned what it is to be a friend and have a friend and be able to look in my friend's eyes and see the friend and not just my own image reflected there. I found new joy in the practice of my religion, and all of this is gravy because the only thing in the world that I was looking for when I came here was sobriety. And if I want to know what it would be like to lose it, I only have to remember those last 2 years when I drank alone late at night, wandering through the halls and down the steps, always going down to get that one more last drink. And I can remember that I used to think even then that surely there must be some purpose in this. It must be leading somewhere. I must be looking for something. And even in my drunken confusion, I turned out to be right about that one thing. I was looking for something, and thanks be to God, I found it. I was looking for AA. I was looking for all of you. I was looking for the power greater than myself that I call God. And now when I am in a room full of people like all of you, and I realize that all through that terrible time you were here and you had a vacancy, I see what a wasteland my pride and my willfulness and my blindness had made of my life. And I thank God I found you when I did. I'm not proud of any of the things I've told you. None of us is proud. And I spent so many years trying to forget stories like these. But I know now that I must never forget, lest I forget to be grateful to God for helping me to find AA. And lest I forget to be grateful to AA for helping me to find my life. Thank you.
Cora Louise. Isn't she wonderful? We have our afternoon, our final meeting this afternoon at 2:30, same place we were Friday night. Dave, do you have any announcements?
Finally got to say something on this floor. The meeting this afternoon, and we've had three wonderful ones, is one you won't want to miss. Virgil will be our speaker, and he has an excellent message. I'd like to ask that all people participating in the program this afternoon be there at least by 2 o'clock. So that we won't have the last-minute rush of getting things lined up. And we'll start right on time. There are a lot of people here who have a long way to go. Eat a light lunch. The ladies of Al-Anon have their usual feast for you immediately following the meeting. Now, I've been asked to announce that the Georgia State Convention will be held at Jekyll Island, Georgia, on October 25th, 26th, and 27th. Dottie has the blanks for your hotel reservation. There's no registration fee. It's free as far as the meetings are concerned. Dottie, will you stand so they can know who to see? Where is she? Dottie will take care of you. If you miss her here, her room is number 15. At least it was a daylight this morning. I don't... Jekyll Island is a wonderful place, and it's lovely in the fall, and I hope a lot of us can be there. The 24th Southeastern Convention, in conjunction with the North Carolina State Convention, will be in Charlotte, North Carolina, 14th, 15th, and 16th of August. 17th, add that too. And they have a wonderful lineup of speakers. It sounds like who's who in AA, except they missed four mighty good ones that we had here. I'm on the program, but I'm not even mentioned here in this one. So they must be good, you know that. And registration forms are here for that. And if you want to get in the hotel where the headquarters will be and all the meetings, I suggest you make those reservations at once. Well, we've had a wonderful get-together so far. We're crowded. There's something been said about a larger place. We like it the way it is. We don't want to get too big. We're just a country town here, and we don't want to get too big for our britches. And some of us have talked about it, and probably the only notices that will go out next year, unless we change our mind, are to those who are here. We can't take care of anymore. We've taxed the facilities very greatly so far. And unless there's a change of mind, we want to hold it right where it is, around 215. And I know you've been impressed with the service we've had here. The girls last night, under the terrifically crowded conditions, got the food to us. Well, it's too hot to eat when it came to us, you know. And I heard several mention who have attended banquets at the larger hotel that they'd never seen better service. And never mind the hand clapping. Let's leave that off. These girls can't live on applause. And we thought that in recognition of the wonderful way they've taken care of us last night and today, this morning, that you'd want to leave a little remembrance at your plate for them. We'll see you this afternoon, 2:30.
Thank you, Dave. Let's all stand and dismiss by repeating the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever and ever.